Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We'll hear a debate between the candidates for Congress from Nebraska's 2nd District, incumbent Republican Lee Terry, and his challenger, Democrat Jim Esch. The debate is co-sponsored by the Omaha Press Club and the League of Women Voters. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 16, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, the League of Women Voters, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Kerr, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Today, our noon forum is a debate between the candidates for Congress and the 2nd Congressional District, the Omaha District, Republican Lee Terry and Democrat Jim Esch. Our debate is co-sponsored by the League of Women Voters. The debate questions have been prepared by a Press Club League of Women Voters committee. The candidates have not seen the questions in advance. The format will be 1 minute, 30-second timed responses from the candidates, followed by an additional 3 minutes for follow-up questions or back-and-forth comments between the candidates, that kind of thing. I know there are a few, just a few enthusiastic supporters of the candidates here, but please, no shouting, clapping, whistling, that kind of thing during the debate. We're going to give you a chance to do that right now, so please welcome to the podiums Lee Terry and Jim Esch.
Jim?
All right, we're going to deal, first of all, with this bailout legislation. And we're going to start with you, Lee Terry. You voted for the second version of the $700 billion economic bailout bill. Why not the first version?
Well, I thought it was important that we improve the bill even more, and we were able to build in even more protections of taxpayer dollars, more accountability within that system, and so that we didn't put as many taxpayer dollars at risk. But I do think that this is a defining moment, not only for America, because we have to battle through this economic crisis. I talked to the experts. I did the research. I talked to local businessmen. And all of those experts said that this is a real crisis. Warren Buffett called it economic Pearl Harbor. Paulson called it doomsday. This is worldwide, and we had to step up to stabilize the economy. Why? Because it was tens of millions of jobs at stake. That's our economy, folks. It's going to hurt every family, and we have to stop that from happening. We also have to look at what's the long-term picture. How do we further stabilize it? Well, first of all, we've got to re-regulate in a meaningful way the financial services industry, so we can't get into this point yet. We also have to make sure that we don't make mistakes like raising taxes and further deflate our economy into a depression. That takes leadership.
Jim, I just want to ask you a direct question with regard to this. You said, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but you would not have voted for the second version either. Is it your view that the bailout legislation was not needed? If something was needed, what would you have voted for? What about a timeline to get this passed? Weren't we in kind of a crunch situation?
Well, I think clearly something had to be done. And obviously the experts were saying that, and Warren Buffett and other people say, this is the Pearl Harbor of the financial world, that clearly something had to be done. But I didn't feel that the first bill, and certainly the second bill, I didn't think had any improvements. I mean, we only threw on another $140 billion in pork and other tax breaks and everything else in order for it to get done. I did not think we had enough in there in terms of transparency or accountability. And your first job has to be to protect the taxpayers. And what I would have rather seen, and it's frustrating because I'm like most of you. I mean, I wasn't out there when all of a sudden this was being shoved down everyone's throats and said we have to act now. But what I would have rather seen is for us, since it was a liquidity issue, figure out a way, all right, whatever that number is. And that was one of the other things is no one ever justified why it had to be $700 billion. I mean, we've never had an explanation of that number, and I don't think you take a number that large lightly. And, you know, I would have rather seen something that we had money that we could have loaned to keep liquidity going, guaranteed bank deposits across the country to make sure there wasn't a run, and to have in place some sort of maybe bankruptcy proceeding so that we can uncover what went wrong and hold people accountable. And I just had a tough time believing that this was our best and only option. And it seems time and time again that we are continually forced to take only one option, and that's it, and that was the only thing on the table. And I just didn't think that was the right solution.
And just to continue along those same lines, another question with regard to that. One of the criticisms is in that in the late 90s, we took all these regulations away, which permitted this situation to develop. So, Jim, ask you first, do we now need to re-regulate? Should we get back to where we were before?
You know, I think we have to have an honest discussion about what are going to be good regulations. And I don't necessarily think that's more or less, but let's put a regulatory scheme in place that makes sense. And unfortunately, over the last 10 years, and this is Republicans and Democrats alike, I mean, in 99, when a lot of this deregulation started, those were both parties saying that, you know, looking the other way and letting Wall Street do what they wanted to do. And, you know, one of my concerns about how fast we're moving on this, and we certainly haven't seen this. I mean, it seems like this plan is constantly changing now. I mean, I guess I'm not exactly – I think a lot of taxpayers feel the same way. We don't know exactly what we just approved. And, you know, we need to make sure we have in place then regulations that make sense that won't allow for this crisis to happen again. And we can do that. And that needs to be a meaningful discussion that needs to take place.
Lee Terry, re-regulate?
Well, first of all, I would suggest that people go to my website and they can read the bill. They can see that there was accountability, that there was transparency, that there's taxpayer protections that have been put into that bill. I would suggest that you read the bill. With the regulatory, I think that's kind of been a red herring put up. There was a re-regulation in the early 2000s of the entire banking industry to modernize those regulations. I think it's a wrong statement to say that it was deregulated. What you need to look at is the political pressures that were put on Fannie and Freddie Mae by people like Barney Frank, who is now chairman of the Banking and Financial Services Committee, and Senator Dodd, and President Clinton back in the late 90s, that said, you will accept more risky loans. Now, I think maybe their heart was in the right place because they wanted more lower-income people to have access to home ownership, but they forced them to commit to buy those. They went from about 2% risky loans to as high as 30%. It was then the Republicans that stood up and said, wait, this is out of control. We need to regulate. And it was people like Barney Frank and Chris Dodd that blocked that. And so it's not deregulation. It was really a maybe well-meaning policy that put us in this at risk. And my opponent likes to talk about contributions, but he's accepted contributions from Barney Frank that helped cause this mess. And I would ask him to return those $2,000 from Barney Frank as well as the $2,000 from Charlie Rangels that has three ethics complaints against him right now.
Let's try, and we're trying to stay within our time limit on this 3 minutes, but I have one other question with regard to this situation. This has had such a devastating effect on retirement accounts and 401ks. Should the time be extended when you have to begin taking money out of your 401k to give the market time to recover, Lee?
Yeah, that's absolutely you have to. It's called the 70-and-a-half rule. I think before this economic crisis, I thought it was a bad rule that you taxed people if they weren't, or senior citizens older than 70 and a half, if they weren't withdrawing correctly. Now it's even more imperative that that is overturned, withdrawn, suspended, whatever the language, so that the seniors will have time to recover within theirs. But this also shows the need for leadership on our economic crisis. I still haven't heard a plan from my opponent yet. It was Sam Rayburn that said, any jackass can kick down a door, but it takes a carpenter to build one. What I hear is kicking down a door and no plan to rebuild it, and that takes leadership. That's proven leadership. It may not have been what the public was crying for, but it was absolutely necessary and the right thing to do. I'm proud that I took that vote to help stabilize our economy, save millions of jobs, and for our seniors and other people that have 401ks and retirement accounts to stop the bleeding that was occurring. I'd hate to see what the market would be like today if Congress did not step up to the plate and act.
Jim, ask your response.
Well, I would agree with the 401k. I mean, I think we should, until things settle down, I don't think there's any reason to force people to take their money now when we have these great losses. But, you know, if we want to talk about leadership, I mean, after 10 years of being in Congress, my opponent is not in any position of leadership within his own party. And now that they're in the minority, even less position of leadership. And, you know, if we want to change these things, we need to elect new people to do that. And the only way that's going to come about is by having people that are willing to buck this system and to run campaigns in a different way. In fact, and if you want to talk about contributions, I sent a certified letter to Lee at the beginning of this when I got back into the race saying let's have this be a PAC-free race, no political action committee money, only money from people from the 2nd District. He didn't want to take me up on that, and I wasn't going to fight this fight with one hand tied behind my back like I did last time. You know, we need new leadership. We need people that are going to stand up to their party, that don't just vote party lines all the time. And I agree with him. I think people on both sides of this of the aisle have been to blame for the mess we're in today. And the only way that's going to change is to get new people out there.
Start a new area. Entitlements. Every political season there is talk of what to do about Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security to keep them funded. Nothing has happened. Will it be any different this time? And so here we go. Jim Esch, what is wrong with privatizing Social Security?
Well, I think the last 2 weeks show what's wrong with privatizing Social Security. I mean, if you know, this in Social Security, and it's a different situation than Medicaid and Medicare. I mean, those issues are looming, are going to be enormous, are going to be very, very tough for us to handle in the long term. And that's the discussion of what we need to do with our healthcare system in general. But Social Security clearly has been one of the government programs that has worked maybe as well as anyone that we've created. And it was set up as a safety net for seniors and for those with disabilities so that they wouldn't be forced to live in poverty. And it's done a good job of that. Now, we can't risk a safety net by investing it into the markets. And the last 2 weeks have proven why that is the case. Now, we do have to have a discussion about keeping it solvent and what we're going to do. But we've done that time and time over our history. And those are minor adjustments that we need to make. And we need to sit down in a bipartisan fashion and figure out how we're going to keep Social Security solvent. And then we're going to have a much larger discussion about what we do about health care in the coming years.
Lee Terry?
Well, first of all, let's recognize that it's a payroll tax that funds both Medicare and Social Security. If tens of millions of people lose their jobs, they're not paying into Social Security and Medicare. So the first thing that we have to look at is this economic crisis and help stabilize that. Then I have an economic plan based on first, after stabilizing our economy, becoming energy independent, keeping $700 billion per year here in the United States. That's going to create even more jobs, that we start paying down our national debt, which we can do by using the additional oil revenues and fuel revenues, $2 trillion that we could help pay down. That's going to help stimulate. We need to make sure that we've got a tax policy that makes America competitive and we grow more jobs. The bottom line here is the more jobs we have, the more people paying into the system, the less likely that we're going to have that crisis in Social Security. But the only plan that I've heard from my opponent was to increase taxes on Social Security. Last night, he even advocated at the debate last night support of the 1983 bill, which started the income tax on Social Security benefits and said that was the way to solve it. I hear from many of our seniors that they don't like being taxed on their Social Security. That's not the way to solve the Social Security problem.
Jim Esch?
Well, let's be clear about something, because Congressman Terry has been saying that I'm lying about his position. He's on record supporting private accounts, privatization of Social Security. So let's just be clear about that. Secondly, my reference to 1983 is a reference to how we need to start solving these problems in a bipartisan fashion. Reagan and Tip O'Neill sat down and decided they were in crisis mode, a much severe crisis than we are today right now with Social Security, which is coming, but sat down in a bipartisan fashion and solved this problem. And my point there is that's what we need to get back to. Not that we should increase taxes or anything like that. There's a number of different ways you can adjust this. Quite frankly, it should probably be taken out of the political discussion since we can't seem to ever get anything done on it, and allow the trustees to decide what adjustments need to be made to keep it solvent.
Lee Terry?
Well, yeah. First of all, on this, the trustees do make their recommendations, but it's legislative that has to make any changes, so Congress has to be involved. But you know what? In the last 2 years, there's been probably almost $1 trillion of new taxes proposed. I have voted against every one of them. I've promised the people of the 2nd District that I am going to fight against raising taxes. My opponent last night clearly endorsed the 1983 bill. I don't whether it was talking about how it came together or whatever, he would have supported a income tax on Social Security benefits and suggested last night that it should be increased as a way to solve Social Security. Now, also, just because I say that you should have your own personal account, there's two reasons for that. First of all, Congress for 40 years have been spending Social Security dollars. Most seniors think it's being held in trust for them. One way to assure that that money is actually truly held in trust is to maybe take a little bit of that off, whether it's within the government, which is not privatization, and being held strictly for them so that they own it as an asset, therefore Congress can't raid it. I think that's an important protection for our seniors.
Let's move on to another question. And this is for you, Lee Terry. Whoever wins this race will have to deal with funding for the Iraq War and for Afghanistan. What are the priorities with regard to both Iraq and Afghanistan? Do we need a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq?
Well, regardless of the discussion of whether a timetable is necessary, one exists now. And it was done the right way. It was done from our State Department sitting down with Iraqi officials and designing a way that the U.S. troops can start coming out of Iraq, coming home at the same time, an orderly process that the Iraqi troops backfill those voids. The president announced as many as 8,000 of our troops are going to be home before Christmas. I love that. I want all of our men and women out of Iraq. What I don't want to cause is that we just start drawing them out, creating a vacuum that's going to be filled by somebody, and it could be filled by those that caused all of this in the first place. That would be more dangerous to our country. So we did it the right way. It turns out that it's about a 16-month process, which just happened to coincide with Barack Obama's. The only difference is it's by agreement with an orderly plan as opposed to just saying, I'm going to start pulling them out willy-nilly. I think that's important. I don't really separate Afghanistan from Iraq. This is all, to me, different fronts, albeit, on the war on terror. I'm glad that things have gone well in Iraq. Things have not gone as well in Afghanistan, which is partially our problem with Pakistan and a change of leadership there. Musharraf was a much better in dealing with us. We have to now work to establish a trustful and meaningful relationship with Pakistan so we can get rid of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda that are developing in the mountains of Pakistan and Waziristan.
Jimesh?
You know, I've been calling for a withdrawal since I ran 2 years ago, and a responsible withdrawal. The war on terror has never been in Iraq. I mean, we should have stayed in Afghanistan. We should have finished the job there. And, you know, all of us should be extremely frustrated with our government that after all this time of being at war, that bin Laden and al-Qaeda are still the men that planned and carried out the attacks of 9/11 are still at large. After all this time, after all this resources and sacrifices and the burden we've put on our military families, that we have not had the leadership to say we're going to go and get the guys that did this to us. We should all be extremely frustrated about that. And we do. We need to have, you know, now everyone's on agreement, right, on withdrawal. So, you know, I guess that's a moot point, and it's something I've been talking about ever since I got into this race 2 years ago. But we need to refocus. I went to Afghanistan a couple of months ago. and saw firsthand how things are failing there again. And we can't allow ourselves to fail there. The border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is the most dangerous area in the world. And it's going to be a different solution than we had with Iraq. We're going to have to, both diplomatically, and we're going to have to look at our military options, but we need to focus on that area. We can't allow, especially in Pakistan, a country that has nuclear weapons, there's no doubt about that. They're not trying to get them, they have them. We've got to make sure that that's a stable country and that we have policies in place that are going to bring peace to that region and for us to be able to pursue our enemies over there.
I'd like to move on unless we have any further discussion on that. And this has to do with the leadership question, which, Jim, as you have brought up, Lee Terry, you have been criticized in some quarters for not being able to acquire a leadership position in Congress. And Jim, as you have held no elected positions at all, what makes you think you would do any better job than Lee Terry in developing a leadership role?
Well, let's look at some of the facts. When Congressman Terry went into office, the economy is expanding. We had job growth. We were paying down the national debt. Today, 10 years later, we know the financial situation we're in. We have a debt that's more than almost doubled now. We're going to be at $10.3 trillion in debt, which, while we've cut all these taxes, somebody's going to have huge tax raises down in the future. And you know, the sense of fiscal responsibility, neither party can obviously claim today. You know, when you look at the positions that, after 10 years, Lee has held, he's not a committee chairman. He clearly was not a member of the team that was trying to figure out this financial mess. You know, I don't know if many of you were watching all the bailout coverage, but a guy named Adam Putnam in the Republican Party, who's actually my age, who's only been there for, I think, three terms, is a third-ranking member in the Republican House right now. And so what it shows to me is this is a question of how hard do you want to work? How many people do you want to get to know? How do you blaze a trail so you put yourself in a position you can make those decisions? We have, and it's just not Congressman Terry, it's many of our people in Congress are satisfied of just casting votes with their leadership, doing a special interest group say, and we can't have that. And I'm asking for the chance to go out there and prove that you can get something done, that you can put yourself in a position to make changes. And that's standing up to your party, and that's working across party lines to get those done. And that's what needs to happen.
Lee Terry?
Well, I think we need to have a real honest look at how Congress works. First of all, I've been proud that out of the three positions, and first of all, I want to set the record straight here. And I've told Robin Tisver from the World Herald and other World Herald, I don't want leadership. That's not where I'm going. That wasn't my track that I chose when I was elected to Congress. I'm a policy guy. I like finding the solutions to the problems. That's why I fought to get on an A-level committee, energy and commerce, because of the breadth of the issues that we get to deal with and try and solve. Our leadership saw in me enough that they put me on with one other sophomore. Only two of us were put on that committee from my class. I am part of the advisory group. For the leader, the Republican leader. The whip has chosen me as the assistant. My regional peers elected me to represent them on the steering committee. So when it comes to support from my colleagues, I've got it. I would love to be a chair of Energy and Commerce if you let me stay there long enough. It usually takes about 24 years to get the seniority on an A-level committee. In fact, the current chairman, who's a good friend, I work well with him, is John Dingell. He was elected 53 years ago. The prior chairman, Joe Barton, who, frankly, we work okay together, I work better with John Dingell, he was 24 years of seniority before he was made chairman.
Jim, you want to respond on this some more?
Yes, I do. I want to be a leader. I mean, frankly, I don't think we want somebody in Congress that says they don't want leadership. I mean, we need leadership desperately right now in Congress. I can't think of anything we need more of. We need people that are going to be willing to change the system. It's a broken system. Every time that you've talked about Congress doing things poorly, it seems to me that you forget you've been there for 10 years. I mean, I'm not sure who we're supposed to hold accountable if we can't hold accountable our own representatives who've been out there. And it's not, I mean, so, if I can't get the job done, I just won't run again. And I don't expect people to reelect me if I'm not getting the job done. I don't want to be out there 24 years to continue to wait to be in a position to do something. We need to do something now. And that's what this election's about. Everyone knows it. Everyone's dissatisfied with the country. Well, we have to hold our leadership accountable. And that's all of us coming together to do that. And if I can't get the job done, then you shouldn't send me back and I shouldn't run again.
Are you saying, Jim, that being a chairman of a committee or a subcommittee is not providing leadership? Because I think it is. And that's my area of expertise. Now, I also have plenty of accomplishments within my committee, and I am looked to as a go-to guy on telecommunications law, as well as alternative energies. That's how you establish yourself as a leader, as becoming experts in certain areas, rising up to where the leadership will say, you are good enough to be a chairman. So I chose that path. There's three leaders. Now, I could have run for one of those, but I want to be chairman, and I've got to be there long enough, and I'm working hard. Jim, you know that I have legislative successes. You don't want to admit it publicly, and I know why you're not willing to do that, but I have. And so I have a track record of leadership that you can go and look at. And right now, with all of the crises that are occurring, I think that people need someone that they can trust can pull through at a time of crisis. I've been there. I've made the tough votes. I've been at those tables, including there was one Republican at the table, by the way. And I was talking to Roy Blunt every day, several times a day. And so I think you need to put in context when you say that I'm not at the table. There's several tables, Jim, that I was sitting at, whether you wish to recognize that or not.
You know, we're going to let this go just for one more round. Do you want to talk to that?
If we're talking about leadership on a committee, you've sat now for 8 years on energy and commerce, the one committee in the House that has everything to do with our energy policy. We are in no different place than we were 8 years ago when it comes to energy. We're no closer to energy independence. We're no close to having abundant sources of alternative energy. And in five of those years, you guys had complete control of everything to get something done. I mean, you talked about it yourself in an editorial in 2000 about the things that we needed to do in terms of offshore drilling, in terms of all these things that we're talking about today, yet nothing has gotten done. And, you know, and the Hill-Terry bill, quite frankly, I mean, 35 miles per gallon, China is a mile per gallon higher than that today, right now. And we're not going to impact that until 2022. We are so far behind the rest of the world when it comes to energy. It's a disgrace. We should be leading the charge when it comes to innovation. That's what's made this country great. That's what will continue to make this country great, if we have leaders that are willing to push forward this agenda.
Well, Lee, you get the last.
That's just flat wrong, people. There was an 05 energy bill that was passed that was not as comprehensive as I wish it was, but it established ethanol. It established hydrogen, and I wrote that section. There were several facets of that bill that embraced alternative energies that I was part of. And the cellulosic part of it, we're going to be building plants, cellulosic ethanol plants. There will be one near Ames that's going to use switchgrass, one in California that does algae, another one in Tennessee that does wood pulp. That's all because of that bill that he says doesn't exist or whatever. But we have moved forward. Now, the House of Representatives, we passed on three different occasions opening up Alaska, opening up offshore to environmentally safe drilling so that we can get those resources, because we realize, like Hill-Terry, that it is conservation, it's alternative energies, and using our own resources that we have here. The interesting part of it is it was the Senate Democrats that threatened filibuster, and they couldn't get 60 votes to overcome that. So when you're placing blame, I think that either you don't understand the process or you just want to mislead in where the fault lies here. I wish we had enough. We would have passed that back in the first time we tried a comprehensive energy bill back in 2002. And that gets to the issue of the trust, because not only, and thank you for bringing up that op-ed that I wrote about what we need to do to become energy independent in 2002, that's how people know that they can trust you. Because you say, this is my plan to become energy independent. Then you work for that. And there's seven of my separate bills that were merged in with those two comprehensive bills that have become law, signed into law.
Lee, we're going to have to cut you.
I would just like to hear a real energy plan from my opponent. I haven't heard a plan yet.
statement, this goes to you, Lee. Statement of fact, President Bush has restricted scientific research on embryonic stem cells to certain approved lines. Tell us about your beliefs with regard to the government's role, the president or Congress, in making those kinds of decisions, and how do you see your beliefs as being different from your opponent's?
Well, I'm pro-life. I think life starts at conception, and that it is a responsibility to protect the most innocent and vulnerable of life. And that means whether or not it comes from a petri dish or through an abortion. And I've stayed true to those values so people can trust where I'm going to be on that issue. I don't feel that taxpayers' money should be funding embryonic stem cell research. There are many people like me, maybe many in this room, that feel it's immoral to create life, to kill it in a medical experiment. And I've never wavered in that. So President Bush's policy of using the already existing lines, I would say that you shouldn't use any embryo for a medical experiment, but to make that life become real. And I'm going to say right now, it's a core value with me. It isn't something I've changed when I'm in a Democrat primary to one where I'm now in a general election, or that I speak to one maybe pro-choice group and give one answer on embryonic stem cell, and then when you're talking to a pro-life group, give another answer like my opponent has done. You don't compromise on the life issue.
Jim Esch?
I am pro-life, and I'm pro-life, period. And I think I've tried to hold a consistent view on that throughout. Now, a lot of these issues, admittedly, are very complex. And I readily admit, 2 years ago, I had a lot of questions about the research side regarding adult stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research. What's underlying a lot of that issue is the issue of in vitro fertilization, which is a topic that no one really wants to discuss. You know, all the embryos that are being created today for research are coming from in vitro, which is couples that are trying to have children that otherwise can't have children. The dilemma with that, and where we've opened up Pandora's box, is it typically creates, well, right now there's estimates of maybe 500 to 800,000 frozen embryos sitting in cryogenic storage today. And there is a legitimate question about what do you do with that? And that's where last time I had a lot of questions about, well, how do we move forward if we've opened Pandora's box, do that. Since then, I've taken a lot of time. And unlike most people on these issues, I don't just believe what's thrown at me. I don't just listen to rhetoric from my party or anyone else. I mean, what's really ironic in this situation is there's not a single pro-choice person who thinks I'm pro-choice, even though that's what you want to say. I've always been consistently against abortion and euthanasia. And in fact, I've also argued that pro-life should mean a lot more than just those issues, that we should be concerned about people not just before they're born, but after they're born, by making sure people have health care and education and all these things that create a good life for somebody. And to me, but what's interesting about this issue is science has now come so far that I think we've actually gotten around this dilemma. And now there's still a number of issues that we have to deal with. But I do not support embryonic stem cell research today, because both to be morally consistent with my stance on being pro-life, and from the fact also I believe that there's other ways to do this that doesn't require us to destroy life. But again, I think the discussion of pro-life needs to move beyond what it traditionally has been, instead of just being a wedge issue and trying to divide voters, to find common ground in how we protect life at all stages.
You know, if we can just quickly, the question was, should Congress or the President be making those decisions with regard to stem cells and other.
I said that we wouldn't use tax. I would not support using tax dollars for that. I thought I did answer the question. Jim, would you like to answer the question now?
No, I don't think that. I think it's an appropriate role, especially when it comes to research. It's an appropriate role for the government to decide what sort of research we're doing. And, you know, that's also been a big part of this discussion is that the dollars that we send into research, you know, the federal government is the one that's really promoted most of the great research that's happened. And so, yeah, we need to have clear policies about how we're going to respect life and what sort of ethical research we're going to have moving forward.
Let's go on to a new topic, immigration. There are millions of undocumented workers in the United States. To find them all and send them back would seem to be an almost impossible task. So do we stay with the status quo, look for a path for citizenship for them? How do we handle this? Jimesh?
You know, this is immigration is clearly an issue we should be very good at as a country. And that's probably the most frustrating thing about this debate is that it seems to be the same arguments and dilemmas that we've had ever since anybody in this room, their ancestors came over here. I think the key to it right now is we have to start with the employers, and we have to hold employers accountable. The vast majority of these people that are coming into this country are just looking for a better way of life. They just want a job. Yet we've looked the other way for so many years on the rules that we have in place that we've created this tremendous dilemma and this enormous burden on our system, both in the educational system, our healthcare system, certainly at the workplace. I think to do that, the first step we have to take is to make sure that employers have the tools to verify somebody's status so that when Joe Smith or Jose Rodriguez or whoever it is comes in for a job, then when they fill out their W-4, you can verify they are who they are and that they also can't be filling out that paperwork in Arizona and New Mexico at the same time. Once you do that, then we have to hold employers accountable, and that's the piece we haven't done. You start holding employers accountable, we can start addressing then the comprehensive reform that we need. We give them those tools, we enforce the rules that we have, and then we deal with the situation that we have after that.
Lee Terry?
Well, first of all, let's recognize that we don't live in the same world where our ancestors, when they came over. Mine were probably early 1900s. This is post-September 11th, and we have to know who's coming across our borders, why, and what their background is. That's how we secure America. So the first step in this process, and I have a much more comprehensive plan than the one-step plan of my opponent. First of all, we have to secure our borders and our entry points, and that's north and that's south and our ports. We have to have more security. We have to use technology on the border to stop it. Once we can stop illegal immigration, then we have to look at a total reform of our immigration laws because I think it's unfair to America and it's unfair to the legal immigrant who comes in. They shouldn't have to wait years and years to be able to get their legal statuses changed or improved. When we reform, then I think within that reform, we create a guest worker program. And that guest worker program shouldn't be based on quotas for number of countries, but really working with our Department of Labor and see where we can supplement our American workforce. I don't want to replace any of our American workforce. Then once we're able to have a legal immigrant society, then wages that are artificially depressed by illegal immigration won't occur. And that's just some of my plan that I've been able to talk about here today.
Jim Ash, you want to carry this any further?
Well, you know, this, again, is an issue that we've been talking about for a long time. And, again, Congress has not been able to act on it. And again, I think it gets to the heart of what this campaign is about, is that we do need new leaders out there that are going to do something on this issue. I mean, we truly have had a do-nothing Congress on just about every issue that you can possibly think of. I mean, the only time we seem to come together is in moments of drastic crisis that we just experienced. And immigration is one of those issues that we need to address, along with health care and education and our foreign policy and energy policy. I mean, the whole litany of things. And we can solve this problem. I think we make it more complicated than this. And, yes, we have to secure our borders. But it's going to begin with employment. You've got to go to the source of what's happening here. I mean, people, we have looked the other way. We've allowed our employers – to abuse the system. And we have to start there. Give them the tools to verify, hold them accountable. Then we can start implementing comprehensive reform. And we can treat people in a humane fashion who are just, for the most part, trying to come here to just give their families a better lives, just like our ancestors did also.
Lee Terry, you want to add?
I would appreciate that opportunity. First of all, leadership works in two ways. One is promoting, the other is stopping. And I'll be sure to pass on your comments about leadership in the House to Nancy Pelosi, Barney Frank, and those that are in charge of the agenda. What they have produced over the last 2 years especially was expanding benefits, social benefits, and access to those that aren't here legally. Some of us have stood up and said that rewards illegal behavior and encourages more undocumented workers to come into our country. And so expanding social benefits to undocumented workers is inappropriate. Fortunately, we've been able to stop probably five or six attempts to do that, Jim. Now, also, again, we got to talk about the Senate here. The Senate produced a comprehensive energy bill that talked about many of the things that we need to do, but they did them all at once. And the public doesn't have trust in the federal government to secure our borders. And what I heard from the citizens of Omaha and believe their position to be true and accurate, in my position, is that we aren't going to believe that you're going to do anything to slow down illegal immigration because you haven't done it yet. You haven't shown a commitment on the borders by increasing border patrols or putting the technology there or even a wall in those places where that would be appropriate. And they said, until you get that done, secure it, then come back and talk to us about reforms and how to work with the 12 million people here, because frankly, we don't believe you're going to do it. So the comprehensive bill that was killed, and I helped kill it and bring it from coming into the House, really put the cart before the horse in the public's eye. First of all, we have to establish a trust with the American people.
New area. And Lee Terry, this is for you to begin with. Our new pedestrian bridge across the Missouri River was the result of a so-called spending earmark. But earmarks have been criticized as wasteful pork barrel spending. As an earmark, do you support that bridge?
No. I'm going to say that there's good earmarks and there's bad earmarks. First of all, one reform that was made in the House, and I don't think made in the Senate, is that you have to show ownership. Ownership spreads sunshine, and I think sunshine is the best disinfectant. Everyone in the world should be able to see who is asking for a bridge and whether then we can decide. Secondly, we should have straight up and down votes on the floor of those type of things. Third, I have believed in the line item veto where the president would have power to X those out. If someone came to me and said, you had $18 million to do what you want with, mine would have been a choice of building affordable housing for low-income families. That's been one of my passions, whether it was on the city council or in government. Just one of my things. But there's no doubt that there's a culture in Congress that I've disagreed with of producing special projects just for your district that you get some political or gain from. And we have to stop that. It may be a small percentage of the overall budget, but in the public's view, and I think rightfully so, it represents 100% of the waste and abuse.
Jim Ash?
You know, I like the bridge. I'm glad it's here. Was it a good earmark? No. It's not the type of earmarks I would have supported. But I think what's at the heart of the question you're getting at is that here's the dilemma we face. And Congressman Terry has somewhat been all over the board. I mean, I think 2 years ago he refused to pursue any earmarks. Before that, he pursued earmarks. We need to reform the process. There's no doubt about that. But we also have to keep in mind, as a state of our size, the only way we get any real money back here in terms of good projects, I mean, research projects for UNMC or for Creighton or for any of the other projects we want to do, is mostly through the earmark process. So as we reform this, as a small state, we got to make sure that we're in a position that we can fight for the dollars we deserve. You know, on average, in any given year, we probably only get about 77 cents on every dollar we're sending out to the federal government. And we have some very good projects. You know, I've been down to UNMC and I've been down to Creighton and seen the things that they want to do in terms of research dollars. And unfortunately, the process, the way it works now, is the only way to get that is through the earmark process. So we got to make sure that our representative understands that while we need to reform this, we got to make sure we reform it in a way that it gives smaller states like us the opportunity to benefit from the projects that are going on.
Lee, you want to respond?
Well, yeah, and I've been I think the earmarks that I've been able to get, or bioterrorism research dollars for UNMC and for Creighton, those help the entire nation, and I'm proud that those universities or colleges are working to really better our country and our community. But the reality is, whether it's Creighton or UNMC, the earmark dollars that they get is a very small percentage of the federal dollars that they get. Most of the research dollars come from the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, where Congress has, that's billions and billions of dollars. They make application, it's peer-reviewed, and it's not based on politics like, geez, I'm on the Appropriations Committee and we're going to take 70% of the dollars for ourselves and our district. So frankly, it would be more beneficial to slide those dollars over to the NIH because Creighton and UNMC are extremely competitive in those areas. So I would say that the right way to do this is increase the funding for our health institutes that are in charge of dishing out the money for medical research.
Jim, you got the last say on this if you want to.
Yet you've consistently voted against increasing the funding for NIH. I mean, we need to reform not only the earmark process, but just about every process in our federal government. And we need people who are going to be willing to go out there and do that. But at the same time, you've got to fight for your district. I mean, we've got to fight for the things that we need here. I mean, that's part of your job as a representative is to make sure that you're fighting for your district. Because no one else is going to fight for your district. So the point I'm trying to make here is while we need reform, we need to make sure that we're doing it so that we protect our own interests in the deal because no one else is going to look after those.
Lee, yeah. Make it.
Well, but the problem with the Appropriations Committee, Jim, is they're taking it all for themselves. And that's corruption, and I'm there to fight corruption. I'm here to fight because people on the Appropriations Committee are taking that money from themselves that would be better off here. So we need to set up rules where they can't do that and that we make the money in an area where our people can be more competitive. That's fighting for our people here in Nebraska.
Jim?
Clearly, you haven't had the clout to get that done, though. I mean, we continually talk about Congress and how Congress has failed at these things.
It's humorous now.
Well, that's the reality of the situation. I mean, if we're going to continue to talk about how bad a job Congress has done, I'm not the one that's been out there 10 years. And if we're going to fight these things, then let's have somebody else. And again, if I can't get it done, then I shouldn't be out there either. But we need people not just here. We need people all over this country.
Yep.
They're going to fight to change this government because that's what needs to be changed.
And I am out there fighting on all of these issues that you're talking about. And so I don't understand the philosophy. Your answer keeps talking
Lee,
to me about change, but yet when I'm fighting for that change, you choose to ignore it.
This goes to Jamesh. We hear all the time how special interests are controlling who gets what gets spent for which government programs through donations to political candidates like you. Is this a big problem? Does anything need to be done to address it?
Yes, it does. And you know, 2 years ago, I ran a race without taking any political action committee money. And I took that stance, and I'll admit some of it was probably a little naive being a challenger because it's pretty hard to change the system from the outside if you're not in there. This go-around, as I mentioned earlier, when I got back into the race, and I got back in late, so I can understand some of the dilemma that I probably put Representative Terry in, but I made the challenge that I wanted to run a race that had no political action committee money involved, no money from our parties, nothing, that we would just fight this race by who could raise the most money from the district. Lee didn't take me up on that challenge. And, you know, as a challenger, you can't fight these fights with one hand tied behind your back. It's especially not fair to the people that are supporting me and working so hard. But once I win, once I get in, I think this is fundamental to how we change our government. Because the process by way we elect people is what has corrupted this process. You know, and it's not just Representative Terry. It's every incumbent. I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. You get 50 to 60% of your money from special interest groups. And if we're going to change that system, and you do end up owing those people something, because we can tell from our policies how much we've polarized this country and created such a winner-take-all system that we have to change that piece of it. And I've been willing to do it, and I will continue to be willing to do that until we have a process that's fair and allows us to have some sort of reform in the way we finance campaigns.
Lee?
Well, I am supported by entities like Union Pacific and their employees, and Mutual of Omaha and their employees, and ConAgra, because they know that I'm fighting for them. And I'm sorry if someone believes that if they accept a contribution from an entity like Union Pacific, that somehow they've sold themselves out. They support people because they believe in similar things. Now, I have, there's a commercial out there about doing nothing on energy. Of course, only 7 of my bills have been written into law. But when it came to doing the alternative fuels part and the ethanol part that I fought on and worked on, the oil companies were the ones bashing me and bashing it. So it takes a true leader to stand up for what's right and what's best, and that's my track record. Look it up. That's about leadership, is being able to stand up and do the right things for your community at the right times, and I have a history of doing that, so look that up. Jim, I'm still waiting for a letter. I have never seen a letter from you. It was sent to my campaign, and I'm sorry it was a certified letter. But I don't know where you sent it, but it never came to my campaign, and I haven't seen a letter.
Not only was it hand-delivered to your campaign office.
Well, I thought you said it was a certified letter.
No, I also issued a challenge to you at the debate we had at the Jewish Community Center. I asked you point blank if you wanted to do that.
You make a flippant remark at a
No, it wasn't flippant. I'm serious about this stuff.
I just looked at your FEC report. There must be.
I know you regret not doing that because now the Democratic Party is fully involved here. Think of what could have happened. Think of how much more money you would have had.
20 labor PACs. So you sold yourself to labor, according to your analysis.
Lee, we got to fight on a level playing field. I would have gladly not taken any of that money. And maybe you regret now not taking
me up on the
challenge.
If you, in your heart, think that makes you corrupt, then you corrupted yourself.
The point here, Congressman, is that the system has corrupted itself because of the way we finance these things. Yes, it has. We have polarized this country.
It takes the individual to be corrupted. I have voted in the interest of this district, even if it was counter to anyone that has donated.
You know, you talked about cellulosic energy, yet you voted against the farm bill that had...
Oh, I'm sorry if I ruined your opportunity for all of your farm subsidies that you collect,
farmer. Apparently Nebraska is not an agricultural state. I guess that's...
No, I frustrated that you have that people in Manhattan, New York condos or condos on the river that are collecting farm subsidies.
I got to break in. We are really up
against
it. And
that's why I voted against it.
We are really up against it. All right. This is the conclusion of our question and answer session. Each of the candidates will now get a two-minute closing statement. And, Jim Esch, we begin with you.
Well, Gary, and thank you, and thanks to the League of Women Voters for the opportunity for our final debate here today. Clearly, this is an historic election. We all know it. We're seeing the numbers, the turnout. There may be 17, 18 million new people voting this election. And the reason those people are voting is because they want change. And they want to see a different way of going about government. The only way that's going to happen is to have new people out there. And I've stated this case throughout this entire debate and throughout this entire campaign. It's not going to be easy. I know the system is broke. I've seen it now running twice against it. It's not going to be an easy task to change these things. But the only way that's going to happen is to have new blood out there, to have people that are willing to fight this system. And that's what I'm willing to do. And I expect people to hold me accountable to that promise. Because it's the only way it's going to get done. And if we can do that, if we can get back to the days where we put our differences aside and we have people that are willing to reach across party lines and they're willing to fight for that common vision that's always made this country great, we can get this place back on track. I know we can do it. And I want to bring that back to the people here in this district. I've got a lot of faith in the 2nd District of Nebraska that we can start being that change that we want to see. We deal with all these national issues here on a local level. And I want to have people be involved and engaged in that process of coming up with real solutions how we're going to change these problems. And if we do that, I believe we can start changing the system. And I'm willing to fight for that. And we talked a lot today about trust. And I want to restore your trust to government. Now, it's only a 2-year commitment I'm asking you to make on my behalf. It's 2 years to give me a chance to see if I can do something. If after that 2 years you're not happy with my performance, I wouldn't expect you to elect me back. And quite frankly, if I don't think I can get things done, I won't. But I believe I can. So I ask you for your vote, and together I think we can make this country great again.
Lee Terry, you're closing.
This is a troubling time for our nation. And we're going to see the greatness of our nation by how we react to the current crises. Will we see strong leadership? Will we see people that's willing to stand up, do the research, and do the right thing, like voting yes on the economic stabilization bill that's going to save millions of jobs? Or the politically correct thing because of the number of phone calls coming in against it and say, geez, I don't have to accept responsibility or show leadership. I'll just vote no and be popular. That's not the type of politician I want to be. I want to be the one that you can trust to do the right thing. And my record bears it out. My motto has been, say what you mean and mean what you say. Yeah, that's from Dr. Seuss, from reading to my children. But it's also my motto. And that's how you earn people's trust. There's vast differences, not only between us as individuals, but where we stand on issues. Where I take the hard votes to make sure our economy is secure. Where I've taken the votes to make us more energy independent and have a comprehensive plan to do that. Where my opponent doesn't. That I believe that at a time of economic crisis, you don't increase taxes on the seniors through their Social Security, and you don't increase the alternative minimum tax, making more middle-income families pay more taxes at a time of economic crisis, or allow the 2001 and 2003 tax benefits to fade away and raising almost $1 trillion of new tax revenue for the government on the backs of middle class and small business. Folks, there is a right way out of this economic crisis into a great America, and that's the agenda that I have brought to the Nebraska people, and I would appreciate your vote on November 4th.
Lee Terry, Jim Esch, thank you very much. Give them a round of applause. Again,
you've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We've heard a debate between the candidates from Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District, incumbent Republican Lee Terry, and his challenger, Democrat Jim Esch. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, October 16th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee and co-sponsor, the League of Women Voters, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be held this Wednesday, October 22nd at 12 noon. The topic, Should Affirmative Action in Nebraska Be Banned, will be debated by Ward Connerly, representing the Nebraska Civil Rights Initiative, and David Kramer, representing Nebraskans United. This program will be broadcast by KIOS-FM next Monday, October 27th at 12 noon. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.